This is Film Forums. We're here to inspire, encourage, and inform you the future of film. Visit film-forums.com for more. Our guests for this episode are Bueno Productions, who in 2007 decided to make a documentary about Ghostbusters. Little did they realise what was ahead of them as they interviewed the likes of Dan Aykroyd, Sigourney Weaver, and the late Harold Ramis. The result, over a decade later, is the best documentary you could wish to see about a film franchise loved the world over. Here's a little insight into their long journey to cleaning up the town, remembering Ghostbusters. Welcome to Film Forums. Today I have with me two very special guests, Claire and Anthony Bueno from Bueno Productions, and also my co-host Juana Rubio. Would you like to introduce yourselves, Claire and Anthony?
Well, I'm Claire Bueno and I'm the producer of Cleaning Up the Town, Remembering Ghostbusters, and I'm the dear sister of...
me! And I'm Anthony Bueno and I'm the director of Cleaning Up the Town, Remembering Ghostbusters, long-suffering brother.
Okay, Juana, if you want to, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, sure. My first question is about the whole franchise. In your opinion, why do you think Ghostbusters became a cultural phenomenon?
that's a really good question, because that was always the last question that we would ask all the interviewees in the doc. It was always, so why do you think Ghostbusters, at that time, why do you think Ghostbusters lasted 20 years? I think it always comes down to For Ghostbusters, the one that kicked it all off, it's just a very solid film. You know, it's a classic of the 80s for a good reason, like Back to the Future and all the rest of them, that they are really good films. They're really solid. You know, everything about that film from one scene to the next works and moves it all on. And it's endured because it's really good. And, you know, stuff like Wizard of Oz and all those and Jaws, they endure because they're just really good films. Once you get past that whole initial buzz and things, it's time that really kind of, you know, and there's many other films that weren't successful at the time, but they went on to be classics after. I think Wizard of Oz was one of them.
Yeah,
so I just think it's always, you know, especially when you get people at a certain age. I was 10 when it first came out. I was a bit older. but it takes it. And then, you know, they did the cartoons and then there's Ghostbusters 2. And I think for a franchise that really nothing happened after like the early 90s, for probably about 20 years, I think it was, it's still, you know, you'd go to Comic Cons, people dress up as Ghostbusters, and you're thinking, you know, some of you weren't even born when these films came out, and you're such a big part of your life. So this is what fascinated us in the first place. So for me, it is just that. It's a great film.
Yeah, but who doesn't love a ghost story? Who doesn't love to laugh? Who, you know, there's romance, you know, there's tech as well, and there's these characters that we all kind of love and kind of invest in, because they're all kind of, even though they're quirky, they're just very endearing, aren't they? So I think, you know, with all of that, and it's just good story writing, yeah, isn't it? It's as kind of as simple as that.
Yeah, and bendy lasers.
When you start doing the research of the documentary, what were the biggest surprises and discoveries that you found?
Oh, I think for us definitely was the ingenuity in the effects. You know, these got, you know, Richard Edlund and his team at Boss Film were literally like creating the machinery to create the special effects. And they would be then liaising with Kodak, going, this is the kind of film stock that we need. It was just, there was just innovation and pioneering effects. And I think for us, that was the biggest surprise, wasn't it, really?
Because I was not aware of that. I mean, it's got to come from somewhere, but it's just one of those things you don't really think about. You don't think of the people who design a computer and all the stuff that goes behind it. But they were just like, and it was all that time, it was all physical and practical. It's not, you know, tapping away. I mean, I play around in After Effects and you come up with some kind of effects I'll add all these together and sometimes it works and that's what you get.
I'm exactly the same, yeah, with After Effects. I kind of dabble around and see what happens. Yeah, absolutely.
It's all a part of the fun of it. But they had to, they kind of do that, but they're like, yeah, designing film stuff, designing lenses and mixing chemicals and what do we get? And it's just, and it blew my mind. And I didn't actually know about Ernie. I didn't know of the amount. You know, I kind of knew what happened with the character, that, you know, the Winston character was in it and then wasn't. And a lot of it was like, oh, it was Eddie Murphy and blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't about any of that at all. And when we sat and spoke with him, it's like, I didn't know to this extent, and like getting the first-hand knowledge of what actually happened at that time. So there was always something that kind of came, which is the whole point. You know, there's, you know, it's like anything really, that, you know, even if you see a live show of a comedian, say, there's the jokes that you want to hear and there's the jokes that you actually I've never heard. And it's kind of like that. You want to kind of hear some of those stories that you've already heard, but you also want to try and hopefully peel back other layers to it. And that, yeah, which was the whole point of the film.
And that's, I mean, that's, you know Ghostbusters inside out because it's, you know, you've been such a huge fan since you were a child. So we had a skeleton, I mean, you know, of a script that we wanted. But, you know, with documentary filmmaking, you also have to allow yourself to be organic and allow yourself to learn and then be open to all the new things and new threads to help kind of make this story kind of more alive, really, isn't
yeah,
it?
Exactly, yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know, to Laszlo Kovacs' expertise, a lot of people just could not have shot that as well as he did.
Because the set was so large, in order to get any kind of depth of field and get any kind of exposure, we had to use big lights far back.
We had come back from New York, and we were looking at the set. They were still lighting it. They were hoisting one of these very expensive Titan arcs up, and it went crashing to the floor. And there was silence all of a sudden all over that stage.
There were 13 of those left in the business at the time. We used all 13 of them.
I think the thing I really love about your documentary was that creative process that you show along the way, that the whole thing was made in the process. Now we talk about the crowdfunding. What was the best and the worst of that experience?
Oh, that was...
well, it was... It's really a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
I think crowdfunding, it's... And you've got to have a bit of a thick skin, which I don't really know we have. I'd say 90-95% of crowdfunding is great. And obviously you do it because you need the money, and we did need the money at the time. But it's very difficult because you tell people through the crowdfunder, this is what we're intending, it'll be finished by this time, and blah 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 blah, and you'll get all this stuff. But you get to that time and you just everything went completely out the window. I mean, we suffered a lot through Brexit. Because when we were trying to get the film finished, Brexit just kind of happened and we were out in the States and it absorbed so much of the funds.
Yeah, because the pound dropped. So
everything cost like twice as much as like, we didn't budget for this. For the most part, it's fine. It's a full-time job. I mean, you mainly dealt with it.
I was like a machine, wasn't I? Though I am a bit of a machine.
Yeah.
I don't have an off switch when there's work to do. I've learned that. I don't know if that's a blessing or a curse, or a good thing or a bad thing. But it was literally, once you start the crowdfunding, you've got to continuously work at it and keep social mediaing. And I'm social media, I have a love-hate relationship with. I think the great thing about crowdfunding is that it brought a community together, and having all that support and including everybody else, whereas it was kind of a solitary process for you and I, wasn't it? Was really good. However, you know, the problem with crowdfunding is if we had a private investor invest in the film, we would only have to answer to one person. You know, if there's a delay, we had to answer to whoever just wanted to berate us, you know, in a public forum without knowing half the amount of stuff that was going on, because you just can't share, you know, there's private things that were going on. Legal stuff that we just couldn't talk about. And also people that are investing into this crowdfunder is that they're not filmmakers, and it was our first film. So we were learning as we were going along as well. I mean, the one thing that we learned, and I hope that we did as well as we possibly could, was that we just kept people informed. And by interacting and just, you know, being as transparent as we possibly could, was helpful. But, you know, you can't please everybody. So, you know, you're going to get slagged off no matter what you do. So, it was very difficult, you know.
I'd say 95% were fine and very and really supportive and really, really helpful.
Yeah.
But there's also that.
Maybe I should have done my, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I was just thinking whilst you're talking, like maybe I should have done my research better, because I didn't actually realise this is your first film. And that absolutely blows me away. You've managed to produce this as your documentary feature. Sorry, that's amazing.
Yeah, no, it's very true. I mean, we
obviously worked on other things for other people and stuff, but this was, you know, our first that we was like, no, we're going to do this one. We worked on one on American Wealth in London. I edited and did all the camera work on that one, and that kind of gave us that kind of opening of like, okay, these documentaries. I didn't, even when we were doing the werewolf thing, I thought, like, I didn't quite see the point. There was already a Blu-ray, there was already a DVD out with some extra features. Like, why are we doing a documentary? And then it's like, I see, you know, where that was going. And it's like, yeah, there's nothing like that on Ghostbusters. And Ghostbusters was my favorite film. And because of Claire's skill set and my skill sets, and they complement each other rather than sort of like compete against each other.
Yeah.
So it was just like, let's give it a whirl. And that was basically it. You know, it's just a great excuse to watch loads of other films and documentaries and go, what are they doing? And how are they doing that? And it was always like trying to just make the best film that we could, really. Yeah. And that was always been like the heart of it. And try not to make any kind of sacrifice just for the good of, well, this will help it sell better, or this is sort of like, oh, this is what these other people want over here. And you know, the one fight was to keep it to the length that it is, which is 2 hours. And, you know, but you put it in front of anyone with, you know, distributors, things like that, and instantly, without even seeing the film, oh, well, it's got to be 90 minutes. It's like, well, no, but if it doesn't work at 90 minutes, but it worked at 2 hours, then it stays at 2 hours.
That leads me in very nicely, actually, into my first question, really. You got this fantastic booklet that you sent me along with the sort of Blu-ray, and you described the documentary as originally being cut down to 5 hours and then down to 2 hours, as you've just alluded to. Can you talk us through the sort of the editing and decision-making process? So who has final say in terms of what is cut, and were there sort of major disagreements? How long did it take? Because that sounds like a mammoth task.
It really was. I can't remember how many hours are. I mean, originally the film was going to be about both films. So I like the logo as like the Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2 logo on it, which in the end, even though we knew the film was dead, we were going to break them up. It's just a part of the branding, and it just made sense that we kept that on. And that logo looks really good. Like Anthony Zard
is amazing.
Always loved it.
Art director.
So it was very much like I think it was 40 odd hours worth of content. And then you kind of like just pare that down into its kind of, okay, these are the interviews and this is how we structured the interview. So we'll bundle them all together and I'll kind of intercut it so it makes more sense. And really like the original 5 hour one, it's a lot of duplicate information and things like that. So when we did the second pass, that straight away came down to like 4 hours, I think, and then down to about 3.5. But it was difficult getting it down to even the 2 hours. And there is a 100-minute version, which was purely for like when we do cinema screenings and things like that, just to make it a bit easier and broadcast. But it is just, it sounds a bit poncy, but you just got to feel it. and you know when the beats are working, and there are certain times when you have to be brutal and think, well, I mean, like there's two bits that I wanted to put in the doc, but I was always adamant, we both were, that everyone we interviewed appears in the film. So there's no one that was kind of left out. Oh, we haven't got time for them or anything like that. It's like everyone has to be in it. It was always a thing. So when we were talking about Goza, we weren't able to interview the actress that played Goza. So it was just like, it's only a couple of minutes, but it's a couple of minutes we need to take away, because every second was literally counted at that point. So there was Goza and there was the containment unit and seeing inside the containment unit. And it was really, okay, if we're going to get away, get rid of that little bit of the sequence, this other bit doesn't make any sense. So in some respects, it's just editing. It's just some things made sense when you remove them. Other things were a lot harder to do. And it's just that having to watch it over and over, or you edit it and then you walk away from it and you go back after about a week. And then you rewatch it again and you just get that kind of feeling of like, I really like it. It's a great bit, but it just doesn't make any. And that's why I bunged as many as I could on the Blu-ray. Cause it's like, cause they just, it just, you get to a point where it feels like the film's starting to drag down or there's too much information. And it is really, somebody says, what's the phrase? Kill your darlings or something like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And it is really hard, especially when you like everyone that you've interviewed and some were just amazing and constantly pouring out information, and Harold Ramis and Richard and Terry and Richard and Terry Wendell kind of listen to them, and you just want to sit and listen to them. You don't want to cut off to something else. You just want to listen to what they're saying, because everything that they say is just a gem, and it's just always engrossing.
What was it like working for Ivan as a director? As a director yourself at the time, were you tempted?
More than tempted. I was more than tempted to help out. What happened was, because Ivan had first produced our stage show in New York as The Lampoon, he used that to springboard into Animal House to make the first Lampoon movie, all successful. Then I did rewrites for Meatballs, the first movie he directed with Bill Murray, and that was successful. There's a fine line. Because we worked improvisationally, we were all trained improvisationally at Second City. And I'd worked so much with Bill by that time. We had a language we shared. I knew how to direct him because I'd done it. It was hard to just be the writer on the set, kind of setting him up or trying to think in his voice. So sometimes I would just speak directly to him, and it kind of crossed the line from writing to directing, you know, tell him how to deliver the line or whatever, what to do. And most of the time, Ivan was fine with that. One time, he grabbed me and pulled me aside and said, don't direct the actors, you know. Okay. but we were great friends.
Are you sort of tempted or allowed to, if that's the right word? Maybe I have to admit, I haven't looked at the Blu-ray extras yet, and I will do because I love the film. Would you be tempted to then maybe put the interview, a longer extended version of the interview with Harold Ramis, for example, on YouTube or as a Vimeo private link or something like that in the future, maybe as a tribute to him?
There are plans for the other interviews, which can't probably talk about at the minute.
Yeah,
because it's in the works, but not set in stone. Hadn't thought about putting it on YouTube, to be honest. Probably, I don't think we would.
I don't know if we would. Not at the minute, anyway.
I don't think it doesn't feel right.
And I don't know whether legally.
That was kind of just off the top of my head, but I guess a more relevant question for this would be, I think, are we right? And sorry if I'm stealing your thunder a little bit, Juana, because I know you wanted to ask about this, but... are we right in thinking there's going to be a second part or a second documentary that focuses on Ghostbusters 2 and some of those interviews kind of going to move into that?
That was it. I mean, I didn't want to make a doc that was going to be like an hour on, say it was going to be a 90-minute film, and I didn't want to have like an hour on Ghostbusters and then just 30 minutes on Ghostbusters 2. Because part of the reason when we started all of this was there was nothing on Ghostbusters 2 at that point. It was just such a limited amount of information. There still isn't a lot now, but there's more than there used to be, especially when we first started, which was a long time ago. So it was just, I wanted to give Ghostbusters 2 its due desserts, because it's a really interesting film, and the whole process of how that got made is really interesting. So it just became a really easy decision in the end. It was either going to be a 4-hour film, which I wanted to avoid doing. And then it was just like, you just sit and you discuss it, and it's like, yeah, that's what we're going to do. So we split it up. It's going to be cool. It's called Too Hot to Handle, Remembering Ghostbusters 2. And we're just editing it all together now.
Did you find any difference between the production of the first part and the second part?
Oh, yeah, huge.
Yeah, there is. It's really interesting. And I think Ghostbusters came around at a time when everyone's careers just come together exactly the right point.
Yeah, they just aligned, didn't they?
Yeah. And it just elevated everyone to a different kind of level, and Ghostbusters is what it is. But Ghostbusters 2, it's weird because like now, 5 years, you wait 5 years for a Bond film most of the time, not always due to pandemics either. And so I just find it's like back then it seemed like an eternity waiting for Ghostbusters 2. But it is a very different kind of process that they went through. And mainly, I would say, from my observations, it was you have the success of one film. It's a bit like when you do any job. I always do this. The first time you do a job, you're super attentive. And then when you do it again, you're thinking, you're so much more complacent. You think, this piece of cake, I've already done one. And that's when everything goes wrong. And I always find Ghostbusters 2 kind of went that way a bit. And I love Ghostbusters 2, don't get me wrong. I'm very fond of it. But you can see, and you'll see through the interviews, that there was a certain case of, okay, well, we're making this film, and now, yeah, we'll just go straight and we'll do Ghostbusters 2 while we're finishing that one. And they were doing so much at one time rather than just focusing on just the one film being Ghostbusters 2. And they wanted, I can't remember why they needed it out. I've got a feeling Columbia wanted it. There was a change in the guard at Columbia, and they wanted that made and out as soon as possible. That's something to do with it. So, yeah, it is. It's different. And as you will see in the documentary when it's released.
Which we don't know when, because we've got an edit, but we've seen that we need some more interviews, don't we? So we've been reaching out to people over the pandemic, and so we've got sort of more interviews lined up for when we're able to travel to the States. Because what we're very mindful of, obviously, is that there is the same amount of love that goes into Too Hot to Handle, as well as as cleaning up the town.
Do you think if you'd known, I'm sure a lot of people will ask you this or have asked you this, but do you think if you'd known what was going to transpire in terms of the years it was going to take, because I think you thought it was going to take you sort of maybe a couple of years, and you admit that obviously wasn't realistic, and then it's taken you more than a decade to really put it together. If you'd known that when you started, do you think you would have gone for it, or do you think you would have thought twice?
Yeah, because I think we're quite belligerent and bloody minded, aren't we? And I think we're eternal optimists.
if somebody said it's going to take you 12 years, you would probably sit and think, but there's a lot more to it than that. I mean, there has been some extremely stressful times to deal with, mainly in the latter half, in the cold kind of distribution kind of like side of it. Just finishing the film off, there's levels of filmmaking. We were talking about this earlier, about when you make anything, there's people that make shorts, there's people that just work on TV, and there's behind the camera, in front of, and all that. And they all have varying levels of complexities to them. And us doing the doc, when it's just, me and thee, and it's like, I'll edit while I haven't really got any other thing else going on. And you sit down when you can to do this thing. And it isn't always, if you can't get in that headspace, that can get really hard.
It was hard for you when Harold passed away.
Harold passed away, that just, it can't help but affect you. I've spent, I can't remember how many years it had been since we'd interviewed him, but I spent nearly every day at some points just sat with him, listening to him again and going through and editing. And then you find out he's passed away and he's not going to see that final product. And I couldn't go near the doc for a couple of days because it really is quite upsetting. You've weirdly build a relationship with him, and we spent about 4 hours with him. He was a really, really lovely fellow.
Yeah, he was lovely.
And you do all of that, and it's hard, but when you finish it and then you start, we'll distribute it now, it's done, nothing else done, I can grade, I can do, it's all done. But then you talk to professional people and they're like, well, have you done this and that, and they talk about online and offline and stuff, which I kind of knew what online and offline editing was, but I didn't know. But then you need to know what online and offline and the differences between the two, and conforming
so that it's legally you're able to broadcast it. There's all a whole QC, quality control, and it has to pass all of these checks before you can broadcast it to the public.
Sorry to interrupt you. For those people who are listening to this or watching this, or even reading it, if we end up transcribing, don't know what offline and online editing is, would you be able to explain that in maybe like a minute?
So online and offline is, so basically if you're a offline editor, you're editing it. You edit the film and you chop it all together and do all that.
You're not working with the kind of the raw kind of high resolution files.
Yeah, like, it's kind of, I think it's changed a lot over the years. It's sort of like, certainly old days, like if you're working with 35mm, then they even put it down to tape, I think, and you kind of edit with that. And then when you know the cuts and the bits you're going to use, then you get all the full stuff, and then you use the negative and you chop it. And as you went into HD, I always edited in full res anyway. So I just thought, I'm doing the online as well. I'm also doing the offline. But when you finally figure all that kind of stuff out, so you can work with that. And you've got machines powerful enough to edit. If you've shot in 4K, you could edit it in 4K. But it's also making sure that film, every frame is the same frame rate, because, the one thing with the doc was, even though all the interviews were shot in the same frame rate, a lot of the motion graphics weren't. And some of those are purely graphical, and you just go in After Effects, you change the frame rate, you render it out again, and all's good. Other things weren't quite so simple. And then you just got to basically sit there and make sure that film and everything is conformed. It's all in whatever resolution it's going to be. It's going to be that version that gets sent and then goes out to the world. So it's not going to be a standard definition version or a HD version. It's going to be the full 4K. Everything's got to conform to being exactly the same frame rate. I mean, on film, it's different because you're probably going to shoot it all in the same frame rate anyway. But because you if everything isn't in the same frame rate, you will get problems. When you're editing, the computer just deals with it. You just, I didn't see the difference. But when you see it on a big screen and you see something that isn't, you see the differences. So all of a sudden that online becomes a really important part. So it's conforming and online. It's just really, it is that. It's making sure that it's, everything's legal. You know, it's gone through the grade. And I think in a lot of cases, like the grade and the online, and that person that you take it to, they'll do everything in, that's their job. They do, because it's their job to make sure they deliver that film. The picture anyway, not the sound, but the picture is all in exactly where it needs to be. Everything's within its legal parameters, like brightness and darkness, wires and colors and things.
So when they did their first scene together, when he comes to check out her apartment, they rewrote it, I think, as they went. And she just raised the tone of it. She says, "You don't seem like a scientist." He says, "No." She says, "No, you seem more like a game show host, you know?" And it used to be a used car salesman was the original line, I think, but it conveys the same thing.
One thing I knew about Bill is that he's really good with women.
The greatest comic leading man of our generation, beautifully executed, and in both films, he really, really carried the ball for us.
Despite the set of goofy quality that he presents, there's something very warm about him, very endearing, very intelligent.
I wanted to ask you, we always ask this question, what one piece of advice would you give to aspiring documentary filmmakers that perhaps you wish you'd been given when you started out? So that's to both of you.
Alcoholism really isn't a bad thing.
You know what? I think you can't set yourself a time. You know, you can't say I'm going to make this film in 2 years, and if you haven't done it, then forget about it. Once you commit to doing it, you have to be committed to the project. And you have to see it through to the end. Yeah. I think it's very easy. Well, no, it's not easy for people just to give up, but it's very hard to keep forging forward and pushing forward. So I think definitely if you make the decision to make this, that to make whatever film, you need to commit and go, right, okay, I'm going to see it to the end. And don't give up.
And it's like anything within this industry is that, you know, whether it's like presenting or acting and things like that. If you're going to say, "Yeah, I'm going to give it a year," forget it. Don't waste your time because, you know, yes, there are people that get to where they want to get within the year. It does happen, but it's, you know, you don't know about all the failures. You always hear about the success stories. You never hear people say, "Well, yeah, I'll give it a try. It was a complete waste of time. I don't know why I bothered." It's always, "Yeah, well, somebody picked me out of the crowd," or da-da-da. They're all lovely stories and they do happen. But you've got to take it into account. There are thousands of people out there trying to do that.
Yeah.
And it is, everything is really hard work, but it, you know, but it's, you're doing something you really enjoy, so it's hard, but you get a lot of satisfaction from it.
And the other thing I think as well is having a great team of people.
Yeah.
Particularly like with documentary, where that there's no, that, you know, there isn't a lot of money, so, you know, really a big part of everybody that's worked with us have contributed because they wanted to be a part of the project.
And so
I think having that team around you who are prepared to commit and be with you and go on that journey with you and collaborate, I think, for you, you know, if I may say, Anthony, what makes you a great director is that you have a very clear vision, but you're a collaborator and you want to hear, you know, the team's views, and you take everything on board and you listen, and then, you know, you apply what you think is right for the film and you have the final say, but you do work as a team. And I think everybody, I'd like to think that everybody that's worked within the film for us have all been able to add their creativity and they've all got their stamp on the film.
It's sort of like, I'd like someone right at the beginning to say, right, the difference between frame rates, this is why. I knew the frame rates, but I didn't know the problems they would cause. Because it is, it's and life is a thing like that, really. You just get through. It's like they say, get used to disappointment and blah blah blah, and that comes in many guises and takes many shapes and forms. And that is something that, you know, it'd be nice, somebody who sort of like said that it doesn't matter how hard you work, how long you work at things and how experienced you get, you will still make those failings. You know, there's big filmmakers now that are still making those kind of, like, you know, they're still, they'll make a massive success and they'll make a massive flop at the same time. It's just the nature of it. And you don't know what each one's going to be. You just try your hardest. And that, because that was, there was sometimes when you know, you go to work with people and something happens and it doesn't quite work out and you think, I should have, why didn't I figure that out in the first place? But it is what it is. Such is life, you know, and you just got to plow through it. You just, you know, always just, if you are going to do it because you really care about it, because you're going to spend a lot of time on it.
Yeah,
if you don't care about it, you're setting yourself up for a fall. And I've done some of those things before and it becomes quite unpleasant. But, you know, it is what it is. But, yeah.
So, yeah, just to finish off by saying how much I thoroughly enjoyed the documentary. And now that I know the amount of the blood, sweat and tears and years that went into it, it just makes me enjoy it even more.
We just want the film to succeed and we just want people to see it and love it.
Get into it. So, you know, coming, reaching out the way you are, it really means a lot to us because don't know whether or not people like this or not. And it's one thing Ghostbusters fans, you know, enjoying it, which is great. Yeah, so it's nice that there are people out there that have really sort of enjoyed the film, really. And that's all we wanted. You know, we didn't set out to make a crap film. Not many people do, but that doesn't always work out.